a counselor, a coach, and a spiritual director walk into a bar. What comes next is either the greatest punchline of all time or a conversational cocktail that could change your life forever. Jake, Liz, and John are offering you a unique three-way perspective on common mental, emotional, and spiritual struggles. Only you know which perspective you need the most. So grab your favorite beverage, listen in, and decide who you're gonna call.
And then we go. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Who You Gonna Call. This is John Malloy hosting tonight with Elizabeth and Jacob, the life coach and the therapist. I remembered what you do this time, Jacob. So welcome back. We're so glad that you are with us. Before we introduce what we're doing this time and the next couple times, what are you guys bringing to our proverbial table tonight? Liz?
You don't want to ask me. You'll be bored by the answer. Guess what it is? Guess what it is, guys?
Grape juice.
Yes! Grown-up grape juice. It's Cabernet Sauvignon. Again. I had Shiraz, whatever that's called, a couple days ago. Should have been there.
Okay, so what's the brand of the cab?
Cheap. I think it's called San Castillo or something. It's literally like $4. It's like, nice. Yeah, it's hooch.
Nice. All right. So,
you know, Liz, I have to say that you might want to start like intermixing other drinks only because we and your listeners will be the first ones to know if you're pregnant.
That's true.
Occasionally I'll just throw in a tea just to throw everybody off, get everybody excited.
Yeah, there were a couple episodes ago you were drinking tea. And I remember thinking, Liz, you want to share anything?
That's the, occupational hazard of being a married Catholic woman in her 30s.
Nice. So a regular cab for you. And, yes. And Jacob, in your mug, what have you?
The good coffee. The black coffee. Caffeinated, may I ask? May I add?
Do you not normally drink caffeinated?
I can't tell. Doesn't work.
Oh, sad.
I do it for the drink, not for the impact.
That's sad.
Yeah. This kind of takes away the point of coffee.
Right. Well, one of the points of coffee, because taste is a thing.
Oh, yes.
And I've been told many times recently that I am a snob. I've come to accept it.
There are worse things to be a snob about. I literally just had this conversation. I literally just had this conversation with who? My dad, maybe? We were talking about if we were like uber wealthy, like millionaires, how we would spend our money. And I said, you know what? I would probably still drive a pretty low key car and have a low key house and not buy fancy clothes because kids outgrow them anyway. Mm-hmm. But man, I would spend so much money on good food, like so much money on like the good wine and the good coffee and the good chocolate, all the good things.
Yeah.
All the higher price cuts of meat.
Yep.
Which right now is everything, but that's a side tangent.
Yeah. That's a different conversation. Are you looking forward to a particular drink coming back into the Easter season, Jacob?
Yeah, my Yingling. That wine.
Nice.
So
classic. Right.
Yeah. Well, how about you, John? What are you drinking?
I have a hot toddy today because here in Central Florida for the past 3 weeks, it has been pollen season. And by pollen, I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but it is a literal dusting of yellow greenness all over the earth from the live oaks. And there's like carpets of the stuff. And it kills many of us proverbially. And we might as well be dead and just behead us, grow a new head. So I have a hot toddy to not only for the honey, the natural honey, which will help with it, but also to soothe all of the things that currently want to kill me in my head, which is my actual head. So.
It's so sad.
It is. You may all cry for me.
Good old springtime.
So tonight and over the next couple of sessions, we thought we would go through some of the rules of discernment of St. Ignatius. And the reason being, as a spiritual director, one of the mainstays for my spiritual direction are the rules that this expert, St. Ignatius of Loyola, has put together to help spiritual direction, to help us understand the interior life. And as I was going through the rules of discernment, I thought, you know what? There's actually some interesting things I'd love to know about how temperaments work into this. and how therapy would work into this. So, you know what? Why don't we have a discussion through the lens of Ignatius's Rules of Discernment on this podcast? So I pitched it to Liz and Jacob. They're like, actually, that sounds really good. So we all read the some of the rules.
We did the homework. We showed up prepared, mostly.
So we're not going to be reading through each of the rules. It's going to be more of an orientation to the rules, and then just as we usually do, a conversation to see where the Holy Spirit takes our discussion.
Amen.
So, so for me, the importance of the rules of discernment is that it gives kind of an awareness of what's going on inside. It helps us name some certain things, helps us understand what's going on, and then be able to actually take an action. And something about that naming what's going on that is so powerful. I'm sure each of you have something similar in coaching and in therapy, where just the naming of something helps, I don't know, alleviate stress. You want to talk about any of that?
You know, the first thing that you made me think of was during my coach training, we were all encouraged to take our Clifton Strengths, to do our Strengths Finders. And my coach, Matt Ingold, actually started a podcast on like strengths. And he would talk about how you need to name, claim, aim, and tame your strengths. And there was such power, and this is obviously from the perspective of strengths, not weaknesses, but there was such power in naming the things that I am naturally gifted in. Mm-hmm. And then being able to see when they were going into overuse patterns or when something was, you know, it was a good thing, but I was twisting it and using it poorly in my, you know, sort of in my, what's the word I want to look for? Just my use of it. It's funny. As soon as you said, you know, name, I think there's power in a name, and we all know that, you know, we know that just from the name of Christ, that just saying the name Jesus can drive demons away. So that power in our words and in noticing things, so I think that's awesome.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Jacob, the naming and identifying things? How does that work in therapy?
Okay. So two things I'll say to that. First off, you got to name the facts, facts over feelings. What's going on? Identify the facts. If you can't identify the facts, you can't accept the facts. You can't accept your suffering. So in the context of how do I heal? How do I progress forward? You got to acknowledge what is. And a lot of times that may not be what you want to see. But you can't change it, or you can't change your circumstances until you recognize what circumstances you're actually in. So that's one thing. The second thing is, and this is the most impactful one that I've noticed, is you gotta name what is keeping you trapped or keeping you hidden your shame. A lot of times when I work with clients who are experiencing shame because of particular actions, that to process those experiences and for them to change that belief, you have to name the action. And even in the context of, and usually this is kind of in the context of like sexual experiences, whether it's trauma or whether it's like action that I did, that when we go through the narrative, you have to be specific. Now, a lot of my clients would ask, like, how specific do I need to be? As specific as necessary. Mm-hmm. So if you're going through the narrative and you're using vague language on purpose, that's avoidance and you can't avoid. So the idea behind that is that when you name the thing, you gain power over it. You take ownership. Same thing in confession. You know, to have a good confession, you need to be specific, because you have to unveil yourself in that vulnerability for you to actually be healed and to actually have that encounter. So those are the two things that I've seen in therapy that requires naming the specific.
Yeah. There is that power in naming because it gives an identity and we know our relationship to it and what it's supposed to be in relationship to us. Like I think of Adam naming the animals, you know, this these are not women. These are monkeys. No, they're not part of, you know, me. But also, like, even as, you know, we're family people, right? What are the first things we do with our kids? We give them, like, picture books. What is this? It's a cow. What does cow say? Moo. Mm. Like, we help them identify the thing so that they know what it is in the universe, how they relate to it and whatnot. And we correct them when they have misidentified those things.
And even before...
And when you make...
Oh, go ahead, Jake. Sorry.
Well, when you make things identify, you make them real. And it's interesting because many, many, many times when my clients resistant about, like, how they feel even, I ask them, okay, let's walk through that. What do you actually feel? Name it. And many times they'll say, saying it out loud makes it more real. And that can be fearful. It can be freeing. It is very freeing, but fearful at the same time, because when it's real, it's real. And you got to contend with that. So that's, again, kind of that level of, you got to name it.
Mm-hmm. And I think I think a lot of the time when you name something, you also surprise yourself by how well you know it and by how deep it goes. I remember one time being in a coaching session where the sentence that came out of my mouth that I was not prepared for was, I'm not capable of making good decisions. And it came out and I ran it all together. I told the coach, I'm not capable of making good decisions. I did not know I was going to say that about myself. You know, it was coming out, and it was so convicting and it felt so believable. Not even convicting, it was condemning. And it was so, I believed it so deeply, and it was clearly a lie. And I think that's the other thing, is sometimes when you speak something out loud, when you name it, you recognize it as a lie instantly. But in your head, it feels like truth. It feels real. It feels very much a part of your identity. But when you speak it out loud and you see, especially if you're in spiritual direction and counseling, coaching, you see that person's face, the person who's listening to you, as you say those words, and you suddenly realize, wait, that is clearly a lie. I remember one time talking to my spiritual director, and I was trying to decide, I suffer from some scrupulosity, and I was trying to decide if I needed to go to confession, and he was trying to help me space my confessions. And I remember telling him that one of the things that was keeping me from going to confession in a good way, that was helping me maintain what he had directed me to do, was imagining his face when I would try to explain to him the thing I was struggling with. I could see that warm smile on his face that would just be like, no, you're all right. You don't have to go to confession yet. And it was, and so I texted him. I said, Father, I just keep seeing your face. He's like, good. Keep imagining my face.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You know, it's, I'll just, like, one last point to this too. When people say, like, and I've done this many times, you know, where it's like, Jake, I'm so confused. I don't know what I'm feeling. I don't know what to do. It's like, not confused. Mm-hmm. You're just resistant to naming what you actually know to be true. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I think in spiritual direction, I've had that same experience, except it's not necessarily a hesitation or a resistance to name it. It's that they haven't recognized what it is until it's kind of raised up to them. They present the facts, like you said, Jacob. And then I say, oh, it sounds like you're in desolation. And then, like, a light bulb goes off, like, oh, and, like, there have been a few moments where the desolation lifts at that moment because there is a naming of it. They recognize that it is the enemy that's at work, that's been working on them. And they go, okay, so that's what it is. Now I know what I need to do.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the beauty of these rules of discernment from Ignatius, is he gives us, he equips us from his own experience with, how are we aware? Are we first aware of what's going on inside? And then, are we understanding what that is? We're naming it. And then once we've named it, now we know what to do with it. Like, what I think of is, you know, those cartoons, again, kid stuff, right? Where there's the rustling in the bush and you're like, oh no, what is it? What is it? And out pops a bunny. It's like, oh, now I know it's a bunny, not like a big mean bear.
Right.
And then, you know, I can just, you know, go, oh, it's so wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's almost like that with the spiritual life. Oh, there's a rustling in the bush. Oh, it's just Satan trying to do his thing. Or, oh, it's the Lord. Right. No, I know
it's
what to do.
It's like saying, what's the saint who woke up and like next to is the devil? And she's like, oh, it's just you. And like,
oh, I remember that story. I don't remember which saint it was.
And I'm like, dang.
No, I heard one of Saint Dominic the other day. It said that the devil was breathing down his neck while he was trying to write. And he reached back and grabbed the devil and said, in the name of Jesus Christ, be quiet in here. Hold this candle so I can see what I'm writing.
That's awesome.
So the devil sat there holding a candle until it melted down to his hand. And then he was released from having to hold it. Made That's me so awesome. Happy. Like, be quiet and hold this candle.
You're
going to stay. You're going to work.
Those are better than like the ones that are fighting physically with
right.
the devil.
Right.
At least in my
so
opinion.
St. John Vianney. So yeah, got tossed yeah. around every night. Oh my goodness.
Or Anthony of the Desert. There's a few of them.
There's a few of them.
Bruises. Ugh. Yeah, I just saw the devil. Great.
Super.
Great.
Super.
Oy. So just an introduction to the rules. So there are two rules. Did you guys know that there were two sets of rules for discernment?
There's no.
The first 14, which is more geared towards the...
That's more than two. St. Ignatius was good with the theology, not so good with the math.
Yeah. Two sets of rules, maybe, is the thing.
There we go.
For discernment. And then there's some other rules that I discovered today as I was geeking out in my book. But anyway, so the first set of 14 is for more of the beginners, where they're trying to figure out who's talking with them, who's guiding them. And so that's really focused on when do I recognize it is the Lord speaking and when do I recognize that it is the enemy of mankind that is speaking, trying to guide me. Okay. And then the second rules are more for those who are more advanced, more mature in their spirituality. When Satan has, I don't know, been thwarted by, okay, you know when it's me speaking and when it's the Lord speaking. Okay, but do you really know if it's the Lord speaking in consolation? Let me now disguise myself as an angel of light, as Ignatius says. And so those second rules are, how do you know that it is the Lord or Satan in this time of consolation? We're not going to those. We're just going to stick with the first.
Because we're just little.
AKA, we're not there yet.
We're just little.
Yeah.
Yes. You gotta be born before we grow up.
You gotta identify the facts.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You hear me. You're my people.
Love it.
So you guys read the first couple rules, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in those first two rules for the fourth chair, fifth chair, I don't know how many chairs we have on this table, but it identifies the person who's moving from mortal sin to mortal sin, or the persons who are intensely cleansing their sins and rising from good to better. So it's like that orientation. Are you heading towards God, or are you just merely skipping your way down to hell? And so something that I thought of, and I'd love to go ahead.
Before you begin, John, can you just like read out loud just for our listeners to just pinpoint the specific rules?
Yeah.
So that when we unpack, then they know what we're referring to.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so the first rule. In the persons who go from mortal sin to mortal sin, the enemy is commonly used to propose to them apparent pleasures, making them imagine sensual delights and pleasures in order to hold them more and make them grow in their vices and sins. In these persons, the good spirit uses the opposite method, pricking them and biting their consciences through the process of reason. And then the second rule, and then we can talk about these two rules. In the persons who are going on intensely cleansing their sins and rising from good to better in the service of God our Lord, it is the method contrary to that in the first rule. For then it is the way of the evil spirit to bite, sadden, and put obstacles, disquieting with false reasons, that one may not go on. And it is proper to the good to give courage and strength, consolations, tears, inspirations, and quiet, easing and putting away all obstacles, that one may go on in well-doing. Mm. So those are the first two rules of St. Ignatius for discernment.
Yeah.
So as you two looked through those, did anything like strike you or grab you from your areas of expertise?
I think the thing that jumped out at me the most was the pricking and biting involved in both. Because it does seem to take some level of real interior knowledge, self-knowledge, to be able to differentiate between the two. I think, you know, in coaching, and what Jake keeps saying is looking at the facts and really identifying the truth of what is happening. And, you know, in my world, separating that from all of your thoughts, your emotions, and your actions. And, you know, it's clear, I think, in this space, I think most people could tell if they were going from mortal sin to mortal sin versus trying really hard to cleanse their sins, going to the sacraments regularly, but feeling that it's just interesting because you're going to be uncomfortable either way. And that's something I talk to my clients about, you know, is like, choose your discomfort. Which version do you want? It's not going to be fun either way. Like whether you're failing and you're miserable, and you're, whether it's, you're not hitting your weight loss goals or your marriage is rocky or all of those things, you can just sit and wallow and be unhappy and snack your way through that. But it's not going to feel good, and you're going to be upset with yourself, and you're going to have a lot of negative thoughts about yourself. Or you can do the hard work to work through your thoughts, to process your emotions, to actually choose to look at the difference between fact and fiction or fact and thoughts, to get out of your victim complex and be like, I have power here and I can choose to act. And if I don't act, it's because I'm choosing not to, not because I can't, because everything is against me. Right. But that's uncomfortable too. So which version of discomfort do you want? Because it's uncomfortable either way, but in this one, you're winning. Like in the version of discomfort where you work on your marriage, where you lose the weight, where you, whatever it is that you're working on, You in and of yourself are getting closer to God and growing as a person in that, even if the weight doesn't get lost and the marriage doesn't get better, you're still gaining, you're still winning. It's just painful. Versus over here, you're not winning and it's super painful. So it's like, choose your own adventure.
Yeah. It's still painful. Just there's one that I guess progresses and makes you more whole.
In the coaching and more free.
Realm. Yeah. Interesting.
I'll say, you know, it's interesting, Liz, because you use the word, like, both avenues are going to be uncomfortable. And it's interesting because when I look at these two rules, immediately I had to look at, or let's say, distinguish between, like, we can talk about mortal sin, but let's say in my line of work, it's not necessarily we'll talk about sin in a direct way. A lot of times it's wounds caused by others. It's so the idea that I look at these two rules in correlationship to how am I responding to my wounds. So it's a little bit of a different mindset where it's not directly just, like I said, talking about mortal sin. But I will make the connection to what you said, Liz, that do I choose to stay in my wounds? Do I choose to stay in my anxiety? And it's interesting because you, Liz, mentioned this context of, well, both are going to be uncomfortable. In my line of work, yes and no, that no one wants to be anxious, but will rather be anxious than totally terrified of the unknown in the possible transformation of the future. And so when I look at these two rules, there's almost a satisfaction in staying in my wounds. And it's almost like paradoxical to think that way, but it is, you know, the resistance that I see in my clients, the resistance even I see in myself and to want to change, is this idea that maybe not, again, in the rule one where there's a pleasure or there's a satisfaction involved to keep you there. It's like, yeah, that's pretty accurate. Versus, again, that biting the conscientiousness of, like, to change will be the most difficult thing to do. And then I would say then on the rule two, when there's an advance where I see a lot of my clients who are like, hey, I'm trying to make this change, that my shift of even how I approach them is more reinforcing. You know, I enter into that space of being that voice of encouragement where when they do something well, two things I do. I, in session, when they do some incredible miracle act, and I do mean that, I'm like, I give them homework and I say, treat yourself. Mm. let's reinforce this behavior. Let's reinforce this new mindset so it becomes the new reality. And then two, I use words of encouragement and model that for them so they can take that home with them. So it's interesting how even when my clients do make that effort to move on from those wounds and heal, that I step in as well and become that voice of encouragement and noticing that resistance that still come up where they're still being bit by that resistance of, I don't want to do this. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's neat to see the rules play out mm-hmm. already in my session.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and two things you made me think of. One is I was laughing because I'm thinking this is very, I mean, it's very much an intended pun, but the first rule is the devil you know. You're comfortable because you know this one and you're like, this is me, you know, versus the fear of the unknown. Because it's true, when you face healing, you now have to face taking maybe more responsibility, like you said, more ownership of the work, mm-hmm. but also of who you'll become when you're healed. Mm-hmm. Like, because that person's going to have new challenges and new struggles. And maybe that even feels scary versus being like, I'm okay with these baby struggles back here that I've kind of learned to master and deal with and maneuver, even though it's making me not the best person I want to be. You know, I know me, everybody else around me knows me, we'll just deal with it. But then to mm-hmm. have to leave that behind. But the other thing I was thinking of is actually very much like, I've been reading The Interior Castle by St. Teresa of Avila, and it's very much her first two mansions, because she talks about them being full of these like lizards and creepy crawlies and things that are trying to bite you and pull you back into sort of the sludge of your life, and you're sort of starting to shake them off, but you're not doing super hot, you know? And so anyway, so that's the other image I had. I was like, oh, all the biting, like, what's it making me think of? It's like, St. Teresa of Avila, she was like,
I've been here before.
Yeah, all the saints. And I like it too, because it affirms, like when you hear it in from multiple saints, from multiple, you know, avenues, you go, this is truth. Everybody was saying.
Yeah. Right. What this makes me think of, and hearing both of you, is that in that first one, there's this, I don't know, interior numbness that we encourage within ourselves sometimes. Like, I remember a time when I had one of those weeks of work where I wish that week of work didn't exist. I don't know if anyone has ever had one of those besides me. But it came to the end of that week of work, and I thought, I just want to kind of, I don't know, release, veg out, just forget what happened. So I flipped on, I think it was Netflix, because we had a thing at the time. You know, you do the search. What's the new thing? Oh, I found a new show. Let me watch one episode. All right. Well, that was a good episode, but I like giving it two or three episodes just to make sure they weren't, you know, bad off the bat. You know, like 10 episodes later, it's like 2 a.m. I'm feeling good about the week, but that wore off very quickly. And in looking at that and just seeing, oh, I was looking for numbness. I was looking for not like a continual union with the Lord and seeing what he wanted to say in that week, but rather just a fleeing, not what does it say in the second rule, rising from good to better, but rather it wasn't mortal sin to mortal sin, but it was just that like coasting almost, spiritual coasting and numbness. And feel like our culture just encourages that so much through screens, through doom scrolling, through you name it. It's that encouragement of staying in coasting land.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I normally think of sensual delights in a sexual way, but you know, looking at it and thinking about like dopamine hits, you know, just looking for the chocolate or the, like that 30, 40 minutes of Instagram, you know, just those, you're just looking. I've even taught my kids about dopamine hits. I'm like, your brain wants dopamine. That's why you're mad when I turned off the movie, because it stopped the dopamine very abruptly, which feels very, it's very harsh. No wonder kids freak out. You know, it's a very instant lack of a pleasurable experience. And so, and as you know, bringing temperaments into this, I'm sanguine, and like the sensual pleasures of life are very, like they're a top sanguine flaw. Like they grasp for those creature comforts. And so it was like, I was feeling convicted reading these rules today. I was like, hey, me. Cozy blankets and yummy food and little, you know, Instagram dopamine hits.
So two things I want to piggyback off of what you guys just shared. There's research that shows that specifically in regards to eating disorders, that there's actually a dopamine release once you get to a point that when you restrict and you feel that pain, there's actually a dopamine release. So it actually becomes a certain level of an addiction. So it's interesting because that experience of, well, I don't want to leave this experience from a chemical perspective. It's like, yeah, that's because you're getting something, you're getting hit from it. Even if it's painful, even if it's still an attachment, even an emotional attachment, which is another thing. So that's one thing. But then two, you know, that what he says, the good spirit uses opposite methods, right? In rule number one, tricking them and buying their conscience. I can't tell how many times, especially with clients that have really good trust and rapport and who communicate like, Jake, I need you just shooting me straight, you know, tell me things that I need to hear. And going back to the idea, like naming the things, where my client, and I've done this already a few times, my clients wouldn't acknowledge the tendency that they normally would do or they think they should do. A lot of should statements. And I would look at them and I would say, F that. or no. Like, and I go kind of that extreme just to point out that, like, I'm calling you out. That you know that that's not a helpful way of thinking. What you need to do. And I'm going to call you out on your BS. And it's interesting because we get a good laugh out of it because, A, it's very direct. And I need rapport to do that. So it's like I don't do that to all my clients who have really good rapport. I'll call it and I'll be very, not vulgar, if for the sake of vulgar, but for the sake of, no, I am not going to give you that one. I'm not going to let you off on that one. I'm going to hold you accountable. And it's interesting because I think rule number one kind of emphasizes that, like, that biting, that the language anyways points out that, like, it hurts. It hurts to be called out. It hurts when you name it or when it's named for you.
And I think within us, whether it's spiritually or non-spiritually, there are things we know we're supposed to be doing, or there is an absence at, in the very least, that we are trying to fill with other things, whether it's God or whether it's just I could be doing better things. And this kind of points that out. Yes, you know that deep, deep, deep inside. And what matters is, you know, what's the trajectory? Are you aiming for better or are you just aiming to, I don't know, soothe yourself?
Sure.
Because then moving into that second rule, it flips. There's that comfort of the good spirit he's talking about here. The good spirit is soothing you, whereas it's the evil spirit to bite. You know, the evil spirit is trying to nab at us and drag us back like, oh, man, you're such a party pooper. Why are you not doing like the thing? Or, do you really have to get up this early to work out? Or, you know, do you really have to spend 50 minutes in prayer? You know, all of those like accusatorial things when we're seeking after the Lord or seeking after better, whether it's in the spiritual realm or I presume in therapy or in coaching. There is this drag of, I don't know, the negative that comes up, I'm presuming. Is that true for you guys?
There's a whole question that we ask in coaching sessions. We ask our clients, what's the tone? And sometimes it's a question of whose voice are you hearing this in? And sometimes it really is God versus the enemy. Sometimes it's my mom. Sometimes it's my cousin. Sometimes it's my best friend. You know, you hear people saying these things to you in your head. But one of my favorites is this tone condemning or convicting? Because if it's condemning, it's not from God. But if it's convicting, if you feel a call to change, then okay, let's talk about that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, does that depend on the trajectory that they're trying to do overall? Like, presumably, so if they're in coaching, they want
normally better. That is at the very beginning of a coaching session when we've uncovered a negative thought.
Okay.
And we're working through and we're showing, I'm helping them see where the thought is leading them. So we're looking at the trajectory of the thought. So this negative thought leads to these negative emotions, leads to these negative actions. And by the way, it's being said in this negative tone. And the more evidence we build up that, okay, this thought is not a trajectory you want to be on, but you can keep it if you want. I'm not going to make you change it. Like you can keep, if that thought feels good to you and you want to hang on to it, you have free will. But I want you to see that the trajectory is not what you're looking for. You know?
Oh my gosh, Liz, this sounds like the second rules. Oh my goodness gracious. Anyway, we're
going to put that this side, but Sean's brain is exploding.
Mind blown.
Well, Liz is, she's there, but.
You know. Right, yeah. That's because she's the life coach.
I am not going to say anything. Anything I say will be used against me.
But that's awesome that you kind of look ahead and see what's the trajectory that this is heading towards. Do you want to go there? Mm-hmm. I don't think you do.
Right.
So let's fix what's getting you that way.
Right. And how what is the trajectory that you want? Then we can work on that next, you know, but we go through the whole negative trajectory first. We'll even do, sometimes we'll do like best and worst case scenarios and be like, okay, worst case scenario, what happens in this situation? You know, and it's always fascinating because they slowly realize like, oh, this is yucky. I don't like this. This is not helping me at all.
Yeah.
My observation with that too is like, there's like different levels of progression. Because there's this idea that, okay, identifying, you got it. You notice that you're having these thoughts. Let's see where that goes. Okay, guess what? It's not leading you anywhere. Let's change them. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. You come back to me saying, you still have these thoughts. Okay, so it's not an identifying problem. Now it's, you're still almost in love with attachment to them. Mm-hmm. So what I do with my clients, and this is something for you listeners who want to take some tools with you. you, again, have to identify the thought. Okay. And it's interesting because it's always going to be integrated. And I will make the argument, and Father Rubinger, I think, talks a lot about how there's so much overlap in our spiritual lives and in the impact from like the devil. Mm. You know, that the world, the flesh and the demon, you know, has a part to play. So it's like, is this the devil? It's like, no, but there's influences to the extent that like there's always going to be integration. Mm-hmm. If we're going to integrate our faith, we're assuming then there's going to be integration of the spiritual life, mm-hmm. and that's going to involve the devil. Mm-hmm. So all that to say, when you identify the thoughts, you then have to, second step is you have to disconnect from them. Mm-hmm. You have to disconnect from them. Now, I use examples, like pretend your thoughts being on, if you've seen Inside Out, the first one, the train of thought, putting your thoughts on the train and send them away. Or putting them on, you know, a rain cloud and letting the rain cloud go away. Now that's imaginative. So I invite my clients to get physical with it, where you literally identify the thought coming and you point. I do this all the time, where my those anxious thoughts or those negative thoughts come in. And I tell it to leave.
Yeah.
And I use my language to kind of emphasize that, like, get out. I don't want to talk to you. Get out. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes it's like, forget you. I don't want to talk to you. Get out. And I would point, or I would like gesture away.
Yeah.
That disconnects my ability to attach myself to those thoughts. And then when you achieve that second step, you then bring yourself back to the present moment, and you do that through your senses. Mm-hmm. Okay, what am I thinking, smelling, feeling, tasting? You bring yourself back to the present moment, and you just play that out, those three steps, continuously until you get into that natural rhythm of, no, I'm living this life of virtue. I'm living myself. I'm healing from my wounds. I'm not going to be distracted by these thoughts that I know to be present, because I identified the thing. I named the thing.
Yeah.
I know where they lead. And I don't want that to happen. So I got to disconnect. And usually that's how I see that rule two kind of play out more physically. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah, that's awesome. So as you were talking about that, I was thinking of actually the next two rules, the third and the fourth rule, because Ignatius doesn't just say, okay, what's the trajectory of your life? Here's the good spirit and bad spirit and how they're acting in where, depending where you're trying to head. The next two rules, he gives us actual terminology and names of things, spiritual consolation and spiritual desolation. So let me read the third rule, which is on spiritual consolation. And here's what he says. I call it consolation when some interior movement of the soul is caused through which the soul comes to be inflamed with the love of its creator and Lord, and when it can in consequence love no created thing on the face of the earth in itself, but in the creator of them all. Likewise, when it sheds tears that move to love of its Lord, whether out of sorrow for one's sins, or for the passion of Christ our Lord, or because of other things directly connected with his service and praise. Finally, I call consolation every increase of hope, faith, and charity, and all interior joy which calls and attracts to heavenly things and to the salvation of one's soul, quieting it and giving it peace in its creator and Lord. So maybe just pausing with that third rule since it's longer. Pointing out a couple things. One, it's an interior thing. It's a heart thing that's happening. But also noticing that it is spiritual consolation he's talking about, not just consolation. There is this non-spiritual consolation. So I don't know about you guys, but there are certain parts of nature that just like uplift my heart and soul so much. Like being in the mountains, it's like, oh my gosh, yes. My whole interior is uplifted. Or like, you know, seeing my kids, or I was just making a bowl on my lathe. Like there are certain things within our lives that uplift us as humans. He's not talking about those consolations. He's talking about spiritual things, the things that draw us or that have us more deeply connected with the Lord himself. And being, you know, body, soul composites, sometimes those non-spiritual things, the Lord will then swoop in with his spiritual consolation, like seeing a beautiful sunrise or seeing being on the top of the mountain. Then he will come in and give us that experience of, Lord, you are so good and you are so close to us. So there's that interplay. But when he's talking about consolation and naming it, he's talking about the interior spiritual consolations. So what did you guys feel when this or think of this rule?
Oh, let me tell you something. Okay. I'm loving the part where he says, likewise, when it sheds tears that move to love of its Lord, whether our sorrow for our sins or for the passion of Christ our Lord, or because of other things directly connected with his service and praise. When my clients shed tears, it's the most powerful, the most moving, and the most transformative healing experience that they could encounter. And because many times it's through an encounter with love. And again, this is not me putting myself on a pedestal, but when I walk through clients and help them identify and they learn how to be vulnerable and to share the secrets, to share the most vulnerable parts of their life, and they encounter the gaze of another, and encounter a profoundness there. The experience of that produces tears. And it's interesting because it's that that freedom of being seen. And that's healing, and that's I would say that I would articulate that as a consolation. Or even just in the context of like shedding tears as processing, like I'm shedding the tears for my younger self who was victimized by someone. That empathy, that shedding of the tears is like, I'm allowing myself to suffer here. But that's a consolation. People want to suffer to the extent that they want to be seen in the suffering, that they want to know that they're alone. Counseling is not just about fixing problems. It's about an encounter where you know you are not alone. And in your suffering, you are given permission to hurt.
That's beautiful.
And so when they shed their tears, they're hurting, but there's a constellation that I'm allowed to be hurt, so therefore I'm allowed to then heal. There's this awesome quote that I just love, and I'm going to just put this in my office. I'm working towards that. By Viktor Frankl, who writes a book on Man's Search for Meaning. Listeners, you got to read it. But this quote where he says, but there's no need to be ashamed of tears, for tears bore witness that a man had the greatness of courage, the courage to suffer. Hmm. So it kind of puts this into play that that constellation is, I'm allowed to enter into my suffering. And in that, do I find the constellation that I'm not alone and that I'm not defined by my suffering, that I actually can experience the resurrection. Goes back to the name of the thing. Mm-hmm. If I can name my hurt, if I can enter into it and process it, therefore I can then be able to heal from it. Mm-hmm. And there's a constellation in that reality.
Yeah.
So you have to learn how to allow yourself to suffer, mm-hmm. to shed the tears. And boy, oh boy, not that I make a goal to make my clients cry. No, I don't make them cry. It's not me doing it. Mm-hmm. But when they have the courage to cry, it's transformative, and you can see that peace and freedom mm-hmm. come upon them. And it's, I just love it.
Yeah, yeah. That surge of the heart in there. Mm.
I love what you said about courage to cry, because I was reading this and I was thinking about times where in my own experience, I've resisted consolation. Mm. Because, you know, for instance, you're in church on Good Friday and they're going through the passion reading and you've heard it a million times, but this one time it really moves you. And as a mom of multiple small children, my thought is, I can't cry. The kids will freak out. Like they'll want to know what's wrong, you know? So this desire to hide tears or to repress them and to hear it written as a consolation, like a gift, is so beautiful. You know, it opens up this whole new world of potential of just allowing God to love you. It makes me think of, I was just reading, I'm not going to remember which one it was. It was a JP2 quote, Mulieris Dignitatum, if that's the right way I'm saying that. One of them, he was talking about everyone's favorite Bible verse, Ephesians, about submission. And he was talking about how the correct way to read that is that the man is the lover and the woman is called to experience love. And this experience of spiritual consolation, if Christ is the bridegroom and the church is the bride, like to allow yourself to experience his love in consolation. It's such a powerful thought that, you mm-hmm. know, to let down your guard and let him love you where you are.
Yeah.
And also just the experience of having, you know, I think we've all had those moments of just like pristine clarification about what's important. Even if it's just for a moment, you like suddenly look around at the world and realize that it only matters as a vehicle to heaven. And you realize that what you actually want is eternity, that you were made for a perfect love. You know, I coach a lot of women on their marriages and, you know, some disillusions about marriage and some frustrations with marriage. Mm-hmm. And even in counseling, Jake, I'm sure you'll back me up on this. I see a lot of counselors kind of on YouTube, at least, tear apart Disney princess movies because they're like, this is why this is damaging. And I'm like, I'm so tired of people saying that fairy tales aren't believable and that perfect love doesn't mm-hmm. exist, because they are. And it does. It's mm-hmm. the story is portraying a higher meaning. It's not supposed to be taken at face value. It's not supposed to mean you will find a human who will love you perfectly in the classic sense of fallen humanity. You are meant for perfect love, and you do receive it every single day. Yeah. And there is more. And by the way, there are dragons. Mm-hmm. And those are our vices. Mm-hmm. And those are the situations that the world throws at us. And there's all the dark things mm-hmm. and the desolation. We all have dragons. And we all have the, you know, I don't want to bring him down to Prince Charming. It's a king. It's a king who loves us perfectly and who is calling us to a kingdom eternally with him. So to see this, like the consolation written down, and to be like, oh my gosh, you know, I think, again, we've all had those snippets of that experience of, you know, the foretaste of heaven here on earth. And you know, to just see it. And even what you said about finding him in the other consolations, I thought of Anna Green Gables when she says she wants to go out into the middle of the woods and just feel a prayer, because it's the setting would be so beautiful and you would experience a prayer right. like in your whole body, because it's so gorgeous, you know. And again, you know, we've all had that moment. I'm going to tell a silly story here. I remember one time at Franciscan, I was walking out of the port and I'd had the most amazing adoration hour with Christ. And I felt so connected to him and I didn't want it to end. And I was walking out and I was continuing the conversation with him. And the wind was blowing like crazy and my hair was down, which is very rare for me. I always have my hair up. But anyways, my hair was down and it was all in my face and it was driving me crazy as I'm trying to talk to the Lord. And I finally reprimanded him like as though he was teasing me. And I said, Lord, I'm trying to talk to you. You've got to let, like, stop playing with my hair. And wind instantly died. Like instantly. And I was like, like, he's so here. He's so present. And he was playing with me, you know, that this real connection with him for just a moment, you know?
Yeah. And this, and I'll say this too, in the context of that presence, knowing when you're in constellation, I think is important.
Yeah.
And I would say the two things, at least in my in counseling that I've noticed how to be present to it, is answering the prompt, what am I noticing? Mm-hmm. Just simply sitting with that. You don't even have to analyze it. Just like, what are you noticing? Mm-hmm. Sit with that. You know, don't analyze it. Don't write it off. Just notice. And then secondly, when tears happen. And I think I mentioned, you know, a couple episodes ago about like the glass eye effect. Mm-hmm. And when someone's about to tear up, the eyes glass over.
Yeah.
But when they finally shed the tears, and I'm like, ask them, can I challenge you for a moment? Don't wipe them away. Mm-hmm. Just let them fall.
Yeah.
And because you need to feel it. You need to validate it. You need to let it be present. Mm-hmm. But then I would ask, if your tears had a voice, what would they be saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's like almost like entering into that space in a unique way. And there's a lot that comes from that. Mm-hmm. But again, it's like, this is what's happening. And this is good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's stay with it.
Yeah. Mm.
As you both were sharing, I was just, I guess, in awe that in each of our three professions, we experience these consolation or a consolation of some kind. A lot of our human experience is that non-spiritual consolation, in Ignatius' words, basically this uplifting of our hearts, whether it's through an awesome therapy session where we're experiencing healing, we're experiencing tears, or we're experiencing the love of God in coaching, seeing a goal, seeing healing, seeing wholeness happening. And that in that, in those moments of human consolation, God then can swoop in, or even just out of the blue, God can then swoop in and let us know he is so incredibly close to us.
Yeah.
And that can, you know, in those three things that Ignatius says, what is spiritual consolation? We find ourselves on fire for love of God. We're saddened by our sins or by just the passion, or we're so inflamed with faith, hope, and love and strength and emboldened to serve God. Like just that spiritual consolation being such a, I don't know, a gift that we do have that choice. Are we going to accept that gift? Thank you, Lord, for this experience of your closeness and how it strengthens me. Or are we going to say, not right now, that feels a little too vulnerable in some sense, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, so I just want to say this one last thing too. When that integration of the spiritual life in the counseling world, I had this profound thought or prayer, honestly, on the way home from work today, because I had this like awesome session where she encountered something true and real. A lot of resistance, but okay, there's a lot of growth, but that when I come to know myself in a true way, because usually I'm working with clients on that level of like my relationship with myself and others more directly than my relationship with God, but it's always integrated. But this idea that when I come to know my true self, I come to know my true creator. When I come to know my true creation and my goodness, I get to encounter then the one who created that goodness. So it's interesting because on the way home, I'm driving, I'm listening to K-Love. And one of the songs I was listening to, that was the refrain, is I'm nobody telling everybody about somebody who saved
me. I like that one.
And it just hit me. I was like, oh my gosh. In a very direct way, even my encounter with my clients and helping them in their healing is helping them know about somebody.
Mm-hmm.
That as a clinician, I'm just nobody. I'm just someone who's here as an instrument, telling everyone, my clients, hey, guess who you are? Mm-hmm. Because you know who you are, you're going to know then the creator. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting because like that constellation is, as Wes Saint Ignatius identifies, is like a heart's movement towards God. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, you're moving towards God when I'm coming to know myself, mm-hmm. yeah, my healing,
yep,
and counseling. So to see even like the spiritual realm entering yep. into the counseling sessions is kind of
There's another song. I think it's called Start a Fire. Is it by Unspoken? I can't remember. But there's a line where it says, "They need to know I need to go," and I love that phrase because it's like, yeah, I'm asking God to use me as His voice, but I'm not the one coming up with any of this. This is just true. It's all just truth, you know, and we've been given it by God primarily, and then His saints spoke for Him as well. And now in this generation, in this tiny itty bitty corner of the world, I'm getting an opportunity to just share that information with more people. But again, it's like you can just stand in that space of littleness and be like, no, I didn't do any of this. Like I got told it by somebody else and I have to share because it's amazing.
Right.
There's such freedom, you know, even just, you know, one of the things I know we're running on time here, but kind of like I'm glancing ahead at spiritual desolation and, you know, it makes so much sense because, you know, I remember learning in coaching that the devil has certain areas in our interior life where he can play and certain areas that he can't touch. But he can play in all the areas that we access the most easily, like common sense and imagination and memory. And I think we've all in our different ways experienced those areas being, you know, teased and messed with by the enemy in our clients and in ourselves. So,
And I think that's the power of these rules on the spiritual realm. And even for coaching and therapy, there are common rules. Because first we have to identify where are we trying to head and what's the interior movement or experience of, whether it is that movement toward God or not. Or for each of you, you talked about that discomfort. But is it a discomfort because, you know, you're just wallowing and settling in some sense? Or is it because, you know, it's a good discomfort because I'm aiming towards somewhere? Mm-hmm. And then talking about spiritual consolation, or just consolation, there are these uplifting things, but they help us know what to do with that, what's going on inside, understanding what that is and where to go. And so I know we're on time. So Ignatius actually tells us, okay, when we're in consolation, in spiritual consolation, what do we do? So actually next time, that's what we're going to pick up. When we're in times of spiritual consolation, what do we do with that? And then I think that's still going to touch on therapy and coaching because when people are in, you know, that heart lifting up, what do you do with them to say, what do you do with this? How do you harness this energy?
Oh, so, that's so good.
Don't answer that now, Jacob.
I know. Jake's ready. He's like, start the next recording.
So, awesome. So everyone, I hope you've enjoyed this session. Tune in next time when we continue our conversation specifically about spiritual consolation, what to do with it, whether it's spiritual consolation or just regular consolation. And we will continue talking about how these rules apply to our lives in these three areas. Tune in next time, share it with your friends, and we'll catch you on the next Who You Gonna Call.